Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, I know we dipped into the archives last week with the death of Peter Bogdanovich, but I'm happy to say we have a guest who's alive and on the horn, and I'm happy to say he's one of the usual suspects. You've seen him on Food Network, you've heard Eat My Globe, and I don't know if you know this, friends, but he is also the president of the Los Angeles chapter of the Unistubs fan club, Simon Majumdar. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. Good to speak to you again.
Yes. How is the fan club going?
Well, it's a small and exclusive group, but I like to meet with myself every now and again and talk about you. She was a fantastic actress, and I think the world is going to miss her. And I've been watching, you know, her films from when I was very young, when she appeared with, you know, Cliff Richard, and then all the way through to her remarkable performance on Sherlock. So, you know, I think people will miss her, but also as a kid watching her in Wurzel Gummidge and all kinds of children's stuff, and she was a great dancer.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, so she was a real polymath. She led a great life. But I just think, you know, when you have people like that and they disappear, you are always going to miss them.
And she was, like you mentioned, she was kind of a triple threat between singing, dancing, and acting, which is hard to come by these days compared to back then. But also the fact that she has tapped into several aspects of pop culture. You mentioned the Cliff Richard films, as well as being on Sherlock, but she was also in a groundbreaking series that was remade in the States and had its own wave of fame.
Which one was? You'll have to remind me.
Till Death Do Us Part.
Oh, of course. Yes, she was. I mean, she was Till Death Do Us Part. People often forget that a lot of... A number of American shows that were very popular in the 70s were formats that were bought from, you know, other countries, particularly the UK. So Sanford and Son is another one that was bought from a British show and then reformatted for the US. And obviously, as you said, All in the Family was taken from Till Death Do Us Part. And partly, you know, nowadays we don't get that so much. Obviously, we do get people remaking formats and doing versions of shows, often not terribly successfully, pointing towards the rather dreadful American adaptation of Broadchurch, Graceland, which was garbage. But you know, they've tried to make The Inbetweeners, and the British have tried to make shows, and they never quite worked out. But in the old days, in the 70s, because of the differences in the screen types that they use, the number of lines on the screen, You couldn't just buy shows from other countries. You had to get them totally kind of almost redone. And so it was easier in some cases just to buy the scripts in some cases and try and do them. But yes, a lot of people don't know that All in the Family, which obviously became very successful, was based on a British show. And what's also interesting is those who've seen the British show will realize that, however kind of controversial Archie Bunker was, by comparison to Alf Garnett, the British character, he was completely soft.
That's true. And you mentioned Steptoe and Son, and I was reminded with talking with my family, we finished the Get Back series, the documentary series, And and of course, Steptoe was Paul's grandfather. So that's where I learned the running bit about how he's very clean because of his, a catchphrase from his old sitcom.
Well, that was the whole point. It was very sensitive. Kind of, as we call them in England, a rag and bone man and his son. The son had aspirations towards living a kind of a more classy life, and it was incredibly successful, but had some sad points because, unfortunately, the actor Wilfred, I tried to think of the chap who played the son. My mind has gone completely blank, but he was a very, very, very successful Shakespearean actor, held in high regard. Was at the Royal Vic with Laurence Olivier and all of this. And then after he did this show, which he did for money, no one would take him seriously anymore. And he would go and do Hamlet and people would be like laughing because of his, you know, of who he was and the success of the show. And in those days, you couldn't go and do lots of different roles and people accepted it. In those, you were accepted for that, you know, that show that was watched by 20 million people. He ended up becoming a bit of a recluse and rather a sad end, which is a shame for someone who was incredibly talented.
Harry Corbett.
Harry Corbett, that's it. And I always mix him up because there was a children's show with puppets called Sooty and Sweep that was done by Harry H. Corbett, and always people got the two of them mixed up.
Oh, boy. So shifting gears a little bit, how was your holiday?
It was good. It was nice and quiet. I just got back. You know, I was working before Christmas pretty heavily, lots of speaking engagements, lots of cooking, doing some filming, and working on, and just as I'm carrying on now, doing some podcast research to record later, you know, in March, maybe early April, depending on how long it takes me to write it. So I took the opportunity just to be very quiet, and then obviously with the Omicron thing coming in, I'm not really trying to go out terribly much. I've just had to go out this morning to do some stuff, but I'm trying to keep it nice and kind of quiet right now so I can concentrate on work at home, which is great because I don't often get big opportunities to spend time at home writing. And I'm working on questions for a very, very special interview for my podcast coming up in about 2 or 3 weeks.
Can you tell us, can you give us a hint?
I can't because I want it to be a surprise. It'll be a really good one.
All right, it was worth a shot. Well, I guess regardless, tell that person about my shows. That's my running bit. For those who have not heard season 7 of Eat My Globe, and you really should get back onto that, Simon, can you give us an overview of the subjects you covered in season 7?
Oh, gosh. Well, what I did, and this actually fits towards what you do now, or what you do, is that I looked at, a lot of it was looking at food in relationship to culture. So food relationship to art, food in relationship to television. I particularly looked at an episode on four famous women from television history, and then four famous men from food television history, both in the U.S. and around, in the U.K., and then I also looked at food in art, as I said, which was really fun. I did food in cinema, so I did two episodes there. One was my own kind of history of food in cinema from the very early days of moving pictures. One of the very first ever moving films of however many seconds was, I believe, Lumiere feeding, you know, his baby, and it was basically feeding baby, and it was 30 seconds. But I also, you know, brought that up to the modern age and then talked about some of my favorites of the modern age and some of my ones that have great food moments but aren't terribly good films, like I would always say Babette's Feast, although I get a lot of grief for that. But it's a very dull film. It kind of redefines dull every time I watch it, but the food scenes are incredible. So if someone could just cut those out. But what was really interesting after that is I then went to one of my kind of pals, Lou Diamond Phillips, who's obviously an amazing actor and appears, but what people may not know is he's just an extraordinary foodie as well, and has won shows on the Food Network and done all kinds of other things. And so we had a great episode where I interviewed him and I got him to choose some of his favorite ones, and then we had a bit of an argument about some things as well. So that was really, really fun. And then we did some other episodes that were terrific too. We just did one on the history of military rations. And then my final one for the last season, which came out just before Christmas, was History of Food at Christmas, which got a great response.
And I know you'll be doing other December holidays as the series goes on.
Well, we're going to look at doing not just December holidays, you know, as people ask me to do episodes on, you know, whether it's Passover or whether it's Ramadan or whether it's whatever, what I'd want to do there is, in all cases, I'd want to get someone who's really knowledgeable about it to come in and really explain to me, you know, how these work and where the food situation comes in. Because obviously there's a lot of kind of rules and regulations that I don't necessarily understand, not being part of those religions.
Mm-hmm. I'll get to Lou Diamond in a little bit, but I was really happy to hear the Four Men and Four Women when it comes to food television, because there's some new names I need to check up and discover. But I also was reminded of a couple of folks, like you mentioned one of them was Graham Kerr, and I had seen some clips on YouTube. And I love telling the story with my daughter, who's now 20. But when Cooking Channel started, they were pulling old shows. Like, they pulled some old Julia shows, and they had some Galloping Gourmets. And when I showed it to my daughter, who was probably in her early teens when the channel first came on, she was amazed that in the first segment, he didn't do any cooking. And I think, you know, she'd been trained by the network, you know, by Food Network, that, you know, you start prepping at least before you go to commercial. And she was stunned that he hadn't done anything yet.
Well, food TV has changed all the way. I mean, if you look at some of the early TV people I mentioned, say on the women's side, Dione Lucas, or if you looked at the remarkable and rather strange Fanny Craddock in England, who was incredible, who was like the kind of very posh French cook. She was almost like the British Julia Child, but she was so kind of into herself that she would dress in and do her performances in front of 3,000-4,000 people with a tiara and a ball gown. I mean, it was incredible stuff. And so, you know, TV has changed from that of food TV. And then, you know, we went through what I call that kind of Food Network side that was a lot of cooking and, you know, actual cooking and doing stuff. Right now we're into the kind of entertainment side, and there's a lot of competitions. Mm-hmm. Food TV changes all the time. But Graham Kerr, for me, and I said this in the episode itself, was one of those people who I watched with, you know, my mother. He was always on at lunchtime when I was, we're talking very young, I was probably mm-hmm. 5, 6, 7, and I just remember my mum kind of not realizing at the time that my mum obviously had a bit of a thing for Graham Kerr because I was too young. But as I think a lot of people who work from home and had kids and used to, this was their kind of moment to stop and have lunch, and they would watch someone, you know, glamorous, which he definitely was, on TV, and he was cooking, and he cooked this very indulgent food, and there was a moment at the end of every show that I always remember where he would kind of, he was always leaping over things with a glass of wine in hand until he stopped drinking, but after an accident. But he would always leap into the crowd of always women, and he would grab someone. Everyone was very desperate to be kind of chosen, but he would get one person, bring them down onto the stage, sit them at a table, and then he would actually feed them, you know, the meal that he'd cooked.
Right.
And with a glass of wine, and it was all terribly, you know. And I think that kind of glamour side of it was something that we hadn't seen a lot, you know, particularly in Britain post-Second World War. And even into the 60s, we were still kind of emerging from our rather grim post-war food side. So it was really, really fun. And it was great to talk about him. But also the others, you know, obviously I mentioned Julia and other people, but I think it was nice to mention some of these people who had come out that we'd forgotten about.
Absolutely. Well, and it was funny. You also brought up, I know you mentioned Martin Yan, and I was one of those kids. I was confused because growing up in Michigan, I got to see Walk with Yan with Stephen Yan, and so there was a little bit of like, wait, that's not the same guy, is it? When I would watch other programs, because he also had the aprons with the puns on them, and if I remember right, it was like, you know, a ceiling. It was my first time I saw a ceiling shot, you know, of a cooking. It was my first time seeing a cooking show, and was stunned that you could film somebody cooking on television. I thought that was the coolest thing. I wanted to do it for a while, and then I found out, well, it's easier said than done. But, yeah, well, that one of those, I'm sorry, go ahead.
We changed. I mean, a lot of things changed because of the way these shows were made. What people don't realize, a lot of Martin Yan shows, and then certainly most of Graham Kerr, that was filmed in Canada.
Right.
And the reason it was filmed in Canada was they were much more ahead of the United States. Well, there was two reasons for Graham Kerr. One was they wanted a British kind of voice, and having moved to Australia, he was British and had a British passport as well, and could work in Canada. So there was a kind of, I think, a green card situation. I believe I heard that mentioned, but I've not had that confirmed. But that was part of the kind of just facilitating it. But also, the Canadians were way ahead of the United States at that time in terms of using color television.
Yeah,
and they're absolutely essentially trying to make this a color show. And the other one I think to mention, and people may not know him, but to me is probably my favorite of all of them, of all of the food TV people I've ever watched in my life, is Keith Floyd, who was this very kind of dyspeptic British bon vivant who would cook. But he was the first to go, well, I'm going to cook standing on the aircraft, the deck of an aircraft carrier, or I'm going to cook at the top of a castle, or I'm going to cook in the middle of a storm, or I'm going to go out on a boat and cook. And he was the first one to do it, and he kind of broke the fourth wall. He was always talking to the cameraman. He was consistently, and I know this from having worked with him as a publisher when I'd been at book signings, he was consistently going, well, let's have a drink, and he would be halfway through a bottle before he even started. I mean, it was, I think in the end that's kind of what got to him. But even when you go to the end of his life, his very last thing was he went out with one of his, he was married three or four times, I think, went out with one of his ex-wives and had a great meal and was really happy, and then went home and just passed away in his sleep. And just after this spectacular meal of oysters and foie gras and champagne so he was, to my mind, one of the great, kind of almost the last of the gourmands, and I don't think we have those anymore. Maybe I could aspire to that.
Well, don't have that ending. But I would say maybe
not that ending, or certainly not for a long while yet.
Right. I was like, Keith Floyd's ending was like Oliver Reed's ending. That's just, not everybody gets those.
Yeah, well, Oliver Reed literally kind of went to a pub and people said, do you want to have a drink? And he stayed there for 3 days or whatever it was. And I mean, I think when you read these stories, and not that I'm kind of condoning it, but when you hear the stories of Richard Harris and Peter O'Toole and Oliver Reed and Richard Burton, and kind of them meeting at the Savoy in London and basically drinking the place dry over weekend, not that I could do that or would ever even do it, but
right.
There is something about it that's so much of a time,
yep,
that you could just imagine. Yeah, and when you hear the stories, if you go online on YouTube, you'll hear Peter O'Toole and Richard Harris, who I think used to share a small flat when they were, young actors before they became, the amazing people who they were. And, and I was lucky that I saw both of those in much later in their lives, but saw both of them in the theater. And they were incandescent. I saw Peter O'Toole in two things. I saw him in, a show with Claudette Colbert where he was knocking on a bit, but also in Pygmalion, kind of in the Rex Harrison part, of My Fair Lady. And then I saw Richard Harris in Camelot. So, I mean, you're talking about some of their kind of signature performances. And when you saw them, there's something about them and that transferred over to the screen that completely lit up the screen. I mean, I don't think there's a more beautifully shot film of a more beautiful actor than Lawrence of Arabia.
Yep, yep. In fact, Noel Coward had the famous quote, he's so good looking they should call it Florence of Arabia.
I haven't heard that, or if I had, I'd certainly got it. That's rather good.
Well, it was funny because there was a moment in one of his last great films, O'Toole's, was Venus with future Doctor Who, and there was a moment when his character dies. Spoiler alert on an old film, but Jodie Whittaker sees a young photo of O'Toole, and kind of stops her breathless, and everybody who grew up watching his films went, yeah, he was like that.
Oh no, he was. I mean, he was astonishing, and also just very, very. I think there was a group in that period of there were beautiful actors, but just people who were, I use that word again, incandescent in whatever field. I always think about Peter Cook as, you know, the, I think, one of the greatest comedians or comic actors or whatever you want to call them, satirist, who worked with Dudley Moore, and he was just astonishing. And when you see them and you see that there's something about the look in their eye, there's something about, I don't even know if it's perhaps because they came out of kind of British public schools and they've got this kind of slightly contemptuous look about everyone else in the world. But there was something magnificent about Peter O'Toole. And Richard Harris was the same. He came from a very different background. He was coming from a kind of rough old Irish kind of background and similar to Richard Byrne, kind of dragged themselves up and managed to go through drama school and really brought a kind of reality to, which I don't think anyone, along with Albert Finney and Alan Bates and that period, there was something about those that they brought. I think that kind of class of British actor of the mid to late 60s, early 70s that was making, you know, Tom Jones and all of those incredible films, I think is something that we haven't seen recently. I'm not sure we'll ever see it again because I think it all came together at a very kind of special time.
Yeah. Speaking of which, how do you rate the food in Tom Jones?
Gosh, I'd have to go and watch it again.
Ah.
It's too long. It's probably about 15 years since I've seen it.
Okay.
That's a nice challenge to go and watch. I mean, I always remember enjoying it.
Well, you know, it wouldn't be the first time there'd be a sequel with a series, so there's that. Speaking of which, I want to go back to your conversation with Lou Diamond Phillips was a lot of fun, and what was really cool listening to it was, because I know we've discussed in the past on the show certain food films. You mentioned Babette's Feast for one thing, but I like the fact that he talked about specific moments like the making of the sauce or the gravy in The Godfather, and so it didn't have to be a quote unquote food film, but there are food moments, and that inspired me to challenge you, Simon. I by the way, listeners, I let him know ahead of time. If you could think of some noted or maybe some of your favorite cinematic restaurants that you would visit, do you have any that come to mind?
I do, I think there's two sides to it. It's probably the best restaurant I've seen on film, and unfortunately it's animated, which is obviously Ratatouille, so I can't even eat there in reality. But the food there looks fantastic, and actually the kitchen works as if it might be a proper brigade, so it's quite interesting to see when they talk about it. And I know a lot of chefs I talk to go, you know, that reminds me more of Kitchen than most other kind of new films. So I love that. I mean, I love... The Paradise from Midnight, which I think is arguably my favorite food film ever.
Yep.
It's just beautifully written. It's sad and yet joyous with the food. It kind of gets to the heart of what happens with a lot of people when they're having to change their food, when they move to a new environment. And there's this, that scene that we talked about with Lou about them just making an omelette at the end of the show and at the end of the next morning and them just sitting there and eating this kind of quietly made, confident omelette, and it was just, I love that. But the one that I think I want to eat at most, and until probably about the early 80s, you probably could, is an actual restaurant that appeared. And I love when it's one of those things, and I'm sure people listening to this will have it, whenever I'm watching a movie or a TV show, I always go and Google which restaurants they're eating in, because I want to know, which is sad but true, and I'll always go and see which bar they're drinking in wherever. A lot of them, interestingly, in LA, they always seem to be in kind of like Taylor's Steakhouse, which is one of my favorites, but old school wood panel, beautiful old kind of steakhouse. But the one that I want more than anything to have eaten in is from the French Connection, La Copaine. Which is obviously, there's that fantastic moment, and I think it's a great moment of kind of setting up the people. You've got the two French kind of smugglers inside who are big and fat and enjoying this. It was a very expensive, very classical French. They're eating frog's legs and Côte de Bœuf and drinking incredible wines and ordering all of this. And then it kind of across, and it was a genuine, you know, well-known restaurant in kind of the east kind of part of Midtown. And then while they're doing that, across the road, you have Popeye Doyle standing there with a kind of a cup of coffee from the deli and a slice of kind of sad-looking pizza in the freezing while he's watching them.
Yep.
And there's just that moment that I think, as well as the food, that film did that. It did it for a reason, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's funny you just brought me to mind. There's a pizzeria that John Travolta visits at the very beginning of Saturday Night Fever. And that's where I learned you could have not only two slices on top of each other, but how large the New York slices were. And, you know, there's a pizza joint on every corner in New York. But, that's why we listen to commentary tracks, so we can hopefully have somebody say this is such and such a place in this, you know, this particular neighborhood.
And also now what happens is that people become quite kind of nerdy about it. So you'll always find a website. I think there are websites called, you know, It Was Filmed Here, or You Can Eat At, blah-de-blah. And because food has become such a big part of kind of everyone's life now, more than it you know, even was in the kind of 70s onwards, I think people are just really fascinated by it. And, you know, the diners that people, whether it's the diner from When Harry Met Sally, or whether it's the, you know, the fake diners of from, you know, Greece, or whatever mm-hmm. it may be, you know, or Arnold's drive-in in Happy Days, you know, there's all these places. To the extent that, you know, a lot of them get recreated now, so you can go to Boston. I don't know if you still can, but you used to be able to go to Boston, and there was a Cheers.
That's right.
So they actually created there. I never went in there, but that show particularly. I was watching it recently. I can't remember why I was particularly watching it, but they had it on. I think I was in a hotel, and they had like four episodes. And I sat there and I just said, this is brilliantly written. It's absolutely perfectly written. It's a great ensemble cast. And then you go and look at that cast. Look at Woody Harrelson. Look at Ted mm-hmm. Danson. Look at Diane Long. Look at Frasier. You know, Kelsey Grammer.
Yep.
Look at. I mean, and this is just, you know, the kind of top part of it. You know, what came out of that thing, and it was the writing. And it, in some ways, which is crazy, Cheers almost gets forgotten because of how successful Frasier was, which is one of the first times, if ever, that you get that with a spin-off. And I think sometimes, if you want, as a writer, not that I'm writing comedy, but go and look at how beautifully Cheers was written, from every bit of it, and the way they created those characters as kind of ensemble characters, I thought was fantastic.
Yeah, true ensemble. I mean, it's I know early on they pushed it as Ted Danson and Shelley Long as the stars, but as that series went on, and there's like, you know, everybody got a shot basically.
I don't know that we get to see that very often these days. You know, you could mention Friends, but that was nearly 20 years ago. I'm not sure now that people invest in them as much, because I think, you know, people don't watch the shows at the same time. You know, in those days, when Cheers was on, it was on Thursday night or whatever, the Thursday night kind of comedy night in the US, or whenever it was on, probably Friday night in the UK. You'd probably watch it when you came back from the pub, or you'd watch it whenever you watched it.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody watched it because, you know, we only had in England at that time, probably, I think at that time, three channels.
Yeah, we had three plus a PBS station and maybe an independent. But yeah, that was the thing to do back then.
Yeah, and you talked about it. And that's why certain things, I think, became incredibly popular. And that doesn't mean that we can't get them now. You know, we've just had it with Squid Games that went completely nuts over here and has become, I think, the most watched thing ever on Netflix.
And by the way, don't worry about geeking out on stuff. I have a thing about seeing movie marquees in city streets. I was just watching a Fred Williamson movie called Black Caesar, and it's shot in 1973. And it's not a movie marquee, but it's a theater marquee letting you know that Wilson Pickett and the chairman of the board are playing there, you know, on such and such a night. But I love seeing those. If you can tell when something is organized as far as a shoot, or if they just grabbed city locations. And I use the example of the first Dirty Harry film, which was shot some of it was shot on location, but others were shot on the lot. And at the beginning of the film, Eastwood, Dirty Harry, stops a bank robbery by shooting a car and it flips over. And there's a scene where he's walking toward the perpetrators, and behind him is the movie marquee, and it's Play Misty For Me.
Wow.
Which was his first film as a director. So I'm like, okay, yeah. somebody was cute and came up with that. Or it's the same film that came, a film that came out of the same studio or the same director. So we all have our little quirks. There's nothing wrong with those. I have a list of films as far as restaurants, and these are all fictitious. Well, I think one might be real, but I have to check on this. But yeah, you mentioned Paradise, and I'm really hoping the Criterion Collection puts out Big Night on DVD and Blu-ray. It's well deserved, and you know, we'll do the commentary track for a certain rate if you let us. But earlier this month, when my daughter came home from vacation or from college for the semester, are you familiar with a film called The Flamingo Kid?
Oh, now is that? I'm trying to think. That's not the Gene Wilder one, is
no,
it?
No. This is Matt Dillon, Richard Crenna, Hector Elizondo.
No, I am not.
Okay, it's 1980. The film came out in 1984, and it's set in Brooklyn in the 60s, early 60s, and Dillon gets a job. He's the son of a plumber, and he gets a job working as a cabana boy for a high-end resort on Long Island. And there's, you know, the two fathers fight over his – it's funny. They would make a dramatic version of this called Platoon a couple of years later. But, you know, the hardworking life or the fast living life. And at the end of the film, he reconciles with his father and his family at a restaurant called Larry's Fish House. And their tagline is, "Any fish you wish." And at the beginning of the film, there's like a guy with an accordion playing, and everybody's singing, and you know, you only see a few moments of the restaurant itself, but I thought that's a great tagline. I mean, that's like, you know, Don Draper.
Any fish you wish, that's terrific.
And
I like that
you immediately start thinking of, all right, what can I get? How would I get it? And the other part for me was it reminded me of a seafood place that I would go to in my summers in Long Beach Island, New Jersey, a place called Morrison's, where they would go and get the fish out first thing in the morning, but there were also guys that worked at the restaurant that were on the dock fishing all the time, just in case.
Fantastic stuff.
So yeah,
all of these. I mean, there's so many of these, and I, you know, obviously being in the food business now, I look at it all the time when I see restaurants, and some are much better than others about how they work. There's a great new film that I want to see. It's getting incredible reviews right now coming out of Britain. It's got, I think, one of the greatest actors of the current British generation, a guy called Stephen Graham, mm-hmm. who has been in many, many things. And I'm sure if you go and look at him, you'll know him. He's been in many kind of TV things, but he's one of the best actors. And it's called Boiling Point. And it's actually based in a restaurant in London. Not sure where it is. I think in Kentish Town, but I may have got that wrong. And it follows in one take, from them arriving to them leaving in this very kind of flustered day in a busy kind of successful restaurant with all of the ups and downs. And I'm told by everybody who's seen it, who either from a film point of view or in a chef point of view or food, going, this is the closest they've ever seen to what happens in a restaurant. So it's called Boiling Point, and it's literally just been released. Stephen Graham, who I think you'll recognize immediately when you see him.
He's a that guy. I'm going through the list now. Boiling Point. He was in the last Venom film. He was in your favorite, The Irishman. Rocket Man, Gangs of New York. Yeah, he's kind of the Blow Dry. Gosh, I forgot about that.
He's brought in, I think, and he can fill many roles, and he's just incredibly kind of emotive, and he gets used. I mean, he's very different style of actor.
Yeah.
But when you see someone like Toby Jones coming in and doing his thing, he's brought in to do. And I think there's this group of British actors who are incredible and win lots of awards. And Mark Rylance is another example who gets brought in. And was in that Don't Look Up that was just on Netflix, and plays a kind of Steve Jobs style or one of those kind of tech billionaire, or more like Elon Musk maybe, in there who's so kind of obsessed with the kind of tech side of it. And Mark Rylance in Bridge of Spies, to me, is something that should have won an Oscar for. I thought he was completely superb in that.
Well, he did win an Oscar for it.
Did he win an Oscar?
Yeah.
There you go. I am. I'm. There you go.
No,
ask me about the next Oscars. I had no idea that was true.
Yeah, it was because it was the year because Stallone was up for Creed, and I think everybody thought it was going to go to him. Everybody thought it was going to go to him, and then. I mean, this is one of the major upsets in if you're doing Academy Award history, especially since the only one I can think of is just as big was like Art Carney for Harry and Tonto. But no, he got it, and that was that just kind of opened the floodgates for him. So,
well, he's phenomenal, even in films that I don't think are particularly good. Spielberg's Ready Player One.
Mm-hmm.
He's great.
Yeah, that's a good reputation to have, is to be you're always good even if the material is not.
Well, it takes us back to Gene Hackman, who was, and in fact, it takes us back, I say this about Lou Diamond Phillips, in that even if something he's doing isn't great, which, you know, he's got good ability to choose roles, but even if it's not great, he's always fantastic and I will always watch it.
Yep.
And Gene Hackman was one of my folks for that. 90% of his films I enjoyed anyway, but there were some, even if I wasn't sure, I would go, well, I'm going to watch that because he's in it, and you know,
he'll bring something.
Enjoy it anyway. Yeah, he'll bring something, and even if it's just that character, you know, and if it's a great film, it's going to be even better because he's in it.
Yep. Speaking of great films, and I still have my Stephen Graham page up here. I forgot he played Billy Bremer in The Damn United.
Interestingly, I love that film, and I think Michael Sheen and everybody else. But I don't like Leeds as a team because they were one of our local rivals to my blessed Rotherham United, although much, much better than Rotherham United, my team, who were, as I say, I used to call Rotherham United nil just to save time. But they're doing rather well at the moment. But anyway, so that team of Leeds in the early 70s was a team that people either you supported them or you absolutely loathed them, and there was no middle ground. They were known as dirty Leeds. They were they were kind of vicious. They were all folks like Billy Bramner who would, you know, literally kick the shirt off you. And I mean, not untalented. They were very talented and very successful, but won lots of championships and things. But I think if you weren't part of their club, as it were, most people just disliked them intensely.
Yep. And thank you for saying shirt, Simon. I appreciate that. another fictitious diner that I thought about, especially in my early film years of my early teens, is the Fells Point Diner in Baltimore, which is in the Barry Levinson film Diner.
Oh, yes, which again is a film I haven't seen for many moons.
This is one I probably watch once a year, if possible. And if you don't know it, it's Barry Levinson's first film as a director, and the cast of up-and-comers were, you have then-unknown Steve Guttenberg, Tim Daly, Ellen Barkin, Kevin Bacon, Mickey Rourke, Daniel Stern, Paul Reiser. You know, they did all right. They want to do
whatever happened to any of them, eh?
Right.
Whatever happened to any of them?
I remember taking my wife to see this film when we were dating, and there's a great moment. And if you're a fanatic about anything, his record collection is organized a certain way, and that he chews out his wife because she doesn't file the records, and finally he just says, you know, just don't play my records ever. And Lynn leaned over to me and said, "You want to push my buttons? Use the word ever in a conversation." And I said, I hear you. So I love Diner. My dad's side of the family's from the East Coast. This was my introduction to French fries with gravy, which, you know, two great things that go great together.
Absolutely.
And then of course, Canada has, you know, it says, hold my beer, we can do it better. But
the best is what they do in Scotland, where they cover chips in curry sauce.
Yes, I had some.
Like, more like the Japanese style of curry sauce, which the Japanese got from the British Merchant Navy.
Mm-hmm.
That sweeter curry sauce was introduced to them by the British Merchant Navy. But that sweeter sauce, and you pour a good lashing of that over hot fried chips. It's one of the best.
Another fictitious place, and I think this might be a borderline tourist trap, but Jackrabbit Slim's from Pulp Fiction.
Well, I got into trouble the other day. We have to talk about that
okay.
character because I don't get him. I don't get it.
Okay.
And there are certain directors and there's certain people who you go, eh. And I, for all of the effort and for all of the stuff and all of the shouting and all of the music and all of this, I just watch them and I go, eh. And I'm not plugged in right. And so I watched Pulp Fiction again the other day. I think we were in a hotel somewhere and it was just on, or I can't even remember where it was. I think it was probably when I was filming and I had to be, you know, I was in the hotel on a day off or whatever it was. And I ended up just watching the TV because I didn't want to walk out in kind of Omicron Central. And I watched it and I just came to the end of it and go, I feel like I've wasted however many hours of my life. And I just didn't get it. And so, you know, apologies to everyone, but I don't care.
Well, this is where I put on my corduroy jacket and play the role of Dr. Soucy, film therapist. No, you're fine. Absolutely. Just stick to your guns, Simon. There's nothing wrong with that. Look, everybody has a yuck that they can yum or vice versa. It also doesn't help that, you know, Twitterverse, you have, the film Twitter bros, are, you know, very angry and all caps all the time. So, you know, don't worry about it.
Trust me, I'm not a man who cares terribly much about the opinions of others when it comes to films. I know what I like.
Yep.
And I don't worry too much about it other than that.
I've learned over the years with this show and as a film critic for 20 years, there are times I've said it in the reviews where I'm like, this wasn't made for me.
His films definitely weren't made for me.
All right, very good. And finally, I think this is actually a place now, but because it was one of those that seemed fictitious, and then I think maybe because of the success of the film, they made it a real restaurant. I might be wrong. I need to double check that. But Mystic Pizza.
Oh, I think they may well have done. Yeah, they well. I don't dislike that film particularly, but it's not one that. I always think about this if I'm kind of scrolling through Amazon Prime or whatever, and there's all these old films sometimes, which I love, and it's, you know, brings us to some of the ones I've been watching recently. But Mystic Pizza is one of those. I go, oh, I kind of enjoyed this, but I'm not sure I need to watch it again. And it's not that I disliked it as compared to some of the others, but it's like, okay. And so, I mean, I'm sure there are films like that, whereas there are films that if I... Whenever I see A Matter of Life and Death, which I think is probably the best film ever made, for me anyway,
mm-hmm.
And particularly because I was always a huge fan, I think a lot of it comes from reading the David Niven books when I was a kid on flights going to India. I would read The Booms of Balloon and Bring on the Empty Horses, which I still think are the best books ever about Hollywood, or certainly Hollywood of that age, because he knew everybody and he was a great storyteller. If you ever go on YouTube, you can see him on a chat show in Britain called Parkinson, which was one of the great shows,
mm-hmm.
where he had all of the most famous people on, and he would just let them talk, and David Niven would just talk. There's one episode where it's David Niven and Peter Ustinov, who worked together.
Oh my gosh!
During the Second World War, Peter Ustinov was made David Niven's Batman, so he could be his valet, basically, so that he was allowed to follow him around while they were making a film, because they were making it together. But he was an officer. But, you know, had great stories. David Niven never talked about it, but he led one of the most kind of ferocious commando teams during the Normandy invasions, but never wrote about that ever, never talked about it. It all came out after he died because it had been secret.
Mm-hmm.
And then it all came out that he was the leader of this. He kind of quit his career at Goldwyn, where he was becoming a huge star and remained a huge star later. But this went off to the Second World War because he was a military man at heart and ended up running this whole kind of commando brigade of these, you know, really tough, kind of the precursors to the SAS.
I know that there's a similar story with Charles Durning, who the great character actor who was, I believe, at the Battle of the Bulge.
Wow.
And then the one that still chills me is, I think it was on Lord of the Rings, where Peter Jackson's directing a scene where somebody gets stabbed and says a sound is made, and Christopher Lee says that's not the sound they make.
Yeah. Well, Christopher Lee was also a very, a very interesting man, quite apart from the fact that he produced, you know, he was a great cook, and he was serious when it came to his kind of military service. I mean, really serious.
Mm-hmm.
What I like about these kind of folks is they're very kind of quiet about what they were doing. That was one side, and the movies was another side, and, you know, playing a character on Guns of Navarone and kind of acting it out in real life was things that they were able to do without kind of, nowadays they'd be sent out by their publicity people with a big thing going, you did this. And it was complete kind of silence. And when you look at all, you know, the American stars also who served, and the opposite side was, if you watched a lot of the American films, then you think that it was John Wayne and Errol Flynn who won the war.
Oops. Shifting gears a little bit with a movie I know we both love, I will ask you, Simon, how would you have prepared Trudy the Rabbit in the film Local Hero?
Probably in my top five films ever. And I always love Bill Forsyth films. So actually, his one before that, That Sinking Feeling, which is really great, and the one after Greg Reeves' Girl, just magnificent guy. That film to me, I mean, apart from the fact that they served up the rabbit, which is a very kind of Scottish, very functional thing to do, and I love rabbit. I love rabbit stew. I love making rabbit pies. I mean, you know, and I think we've kind of ruined our appetite for rabbit because of kind of Walt Disney. And we've all watched Thumper too many times, but I love rabbit. And, you know, I've hunted rabbit and all of that. But that film, in terms of just that gentle, funny, quirky, we've talked about Ealing before. This kind of has a direct remnant through to, you know, Passport to Pimlico or whatever. It's got that feeling about Whiskey Galore.
Whiskey Galore, yeah.
It's definitely got a feeling of Whiskey Galore about it. And there's just those elements of forgotten the name of the gentleman now sitting on the beach with saying that if you count the grains.
Oh, yes, yes. So, yep.
The guy who later appeared in Fraggle Rock, which is an odd thing to remember. But you just... And he was Fulton MacKay. That's who it was.
Okay.
Fulton MacKay. He became a big star in England as a very mean prison officer in a great comedy called Porridge, which they also made into an American show. Going back to what we talked about at the beginning, which didn't last very long. It was called On the Rocks.
Okay.
And it was a comedy series based on porridge is like a term in England for doing time.
Mm-hmm.
And it had one of the great actors in Britain who wrote it, and called Ronnie Barker, who was in The Two Ronnies and appeared with John Cleese and in all of those great things. Anyway, Fulton MacKay was in that. But in this show, he just plays this very wise, older guy. He was very much part of that whole Bill Forsyth kind of team. But I love, you know, the fact that the American imports worked well in that too. And then, of course, it probably has the greatest soundtrack of any film. Or certainly up there.
The great Mark Knopfler, yep.
Yeah, I mean, and the moment you hear the theme from Local Hero playing, if people haven't heard it, they should go on and just go onto YouTube and listen to it. Because to me, that's the moment I hear that, it's that kind of Proustian thing. You're immediately in the kind of place. You know where you are. It sums up that scene, and I'm going to have to go and look that up and just watch it again, because it's been too long since I watched that. And it is, that's as close to me to like what I call Sunday afternoon perfection. There's a saying on one of mine, and I've talked to you about them before, one of my favorite kind of movie shows, on the radio, Commode and Mayo on the BBC, and they, Mark Commode's hugely, he's got doctorates in film, and but they're also very kind of, it's a great show. And they talk about these as what we call in England a Sunday afternoon, nice cup of tea and a biscuit kind of film. And you sit there, and it's films like Calendar Girls or The Full Monty,
yep.
or where basically everyone's up against it, and it's very British. Like, I don't know, I'm not, you know, it's not because there are films that are very American that are great, but in this, like, yeah, we've talked about Bogdanovich, you know, and Picture Show and all of those. That you couldn't make those anywhere else, but Local Hero mm-hmm. could not have been made anywhere else than by a British kind of filmmaker, I think.
Yep, Englishman that went up a hill and came down a mountain, brassed Perfect. Off. Yeah, well, of course, if any location that has Tara Fitzgerald, I'm hanging out there. But
and also, what's another one I think fits up there, and you know. Because of, you know, sometimes people's prejudices. I think Pride is another one that is brilliantly done,
mm-hmm.
Which was all about, and it's a true story about a kind of gay pride organization in London that they don't get, you know, they're struggling to, you know, particularly in the 80s, and there was a lot, you know, not a lot of support, and it was a hard time for a lot of people. And they go, well, who are the people who are also struggling? And they find out these Welsh miners who are on strike in Wales, in the Welsh Wales, kind of South Wales. And they go up there, and they kind of the two. And they're very disparate groups. You can imagine
mm-hmm.
Welsh, you know, kind of middle-aged Welsh mining men, and some younger, but like very kind of working class. They don't know that they perhaps knew anything about kind of gay pride or the gay community. And then the two of them connect, and at first it's all a little, you know, in the film, it's a few battles and everyone getting there, but slowly, you know, they end up coming together, and the kind of gay pride movement walks with them in the miners' marches. And then it's apparently a true story that they were doing the gay pride, and some of these 30 coaches of kind of burly Welsh miners turned up to march with them, and they talk about it in the film. If you haven't seen it, it's just, to me, just a terrific film.
It sounds like it could be on a double bill with Kinky Boots.
Which is, you know, I think these films sometimes, the films that I go, at the end of it, I go, oh, well, that was nice. I enjoyed that.
Yep.
And I think we kind of forget that sometimes, that we expect everything to change our lives, and everything's got to be an event, and unfortunately, you know, I've had two recently that are all supposed to be events that I thought were complete garbage. I hated the new Matrix.
Uh-huh.
It was like I, you know, at least I know how to fall asleep. Well, what I'd do is I'd start with that, and then although I wouldn't be sure I'd ever wake up again, would be the Eternals, which was just dreadful. It was just awful, and we're just like. I mean, talk about a yawn fest. And I was like, I'm watching it, and it's like literally watching someone like paint the screen in front of me with like, anyway, some people might like it. And I don't get me wrong, this is not about MCU. I like some MCU stuff.
Right.
And I thought Shang-Chi was fantastic, and I love Doctor Strange, and I thought the two Endgames, the Avengers ones, were remarkable and will kind of go down in history is really terrific, smart filmmaking. So, you know, Scorsese was just being an idiot when he was saying they're not movies. And certainly better movies than The Bloody Irishman, which was just, oh my God, I think it's still going on. I think I put it on 3 years ago, and I think it's still running.
See, that's my bit on the 17 endings of Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. It's still ending.
And yet that still didn't feel as interminable as The Hobbit.
Nice. Oh, that's good. Simon, I know you got to run, but please tell everyone your social media and all your information so they can see you and hear you more.
Absolutely. If you're on Twitter or Instagram, at Simon Majumdar, same on Facebook. It's always me, you know, it's always me who answers. If you've got any questions, if you want to tell me off for some of my opinions on the worst of the MCU, Ant-Man and the Wasp, or anything else. I love to chat, and go on my website, sign up for our newsletter. We send out great recipes, and we talk about the Eat My Globe podcast. And if you get a chance, go and listen to the Eat My Globe interview with Lou Diamond Phillips and my episode on the history of food in cinema. And hopefully you'll persuade you to go and listen to, we've got about 70 episodes now on there on the history of everything from tea to coffee to brandy to the history of beef, all kinds of fun things. So if you kind of still like me after my rude words about some films, then go and listen.
All right, Simon, we will have you back on to preview season 8, hopefully very soon. Thank you for your time.
Take care, my friend.
Yeah. Always good to have Simon on the show. That's just fun. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Before we grab a pencil, I'm going to tell you about a few films I watched this week and what's going on around the state, and then we'll grab a pencil, okay? So quite a good week. Finally, in Indianapolis is probably the front runner for Best Foreign Film, the Japanese drama Drive My Car, which I can best describe as an intimate epic. Get ready for this, friends. It's almost 3 hours long, but it's a story about an artist, a playwright, or a director and an actor who's famous for his production of Uncle Vanya, who winds up taking a residency in Hiroshima, depending on whatever, and the driver and a relationship he establishes, not quite what you think, with his 20-something female driver. I said this is an intimate epic because you don't get the title seat, you don't get the credits until almost half hour into it. We get a whole backstory as to how Kafuku, Yusuke Kafuku, that's the character, played by Hideyoshi Nishijima, gets to the point of this residency. Quite a bit has happened in his film, in his life prior to this. So there's a huge setup. And then we get into not only the creative process, him casting, rehearsing a production of Uncle Vanya, but also what he's going through at this point in his life, as well as the connection that he has with his driver. So I almost put it in the Memoria school of it's hypnotic, it's meditative at times. It takes its time. I don't think it's a slow-paced film, but it's not a slow film. And really understated performances by everybody. And kudos to writer-director Ryusuke Hamaguchi for pulling this off. I was not exhausted or bored by the time we get to the end, by the time we get to almost hour three. Very powerful drama of not just connecting with people, but also a good look at the creative process, especially when you're doing some non-traditional casting of, and not quite what you think, of actors in this production of Uncle Vanya. So finally in Indianapolis is Drive My Car. Go check it out. Also, really solid Blu-ray release from Wellgo USA Entertainment. It's a Korean drama called Escape from Mogadishu. Apparently, it was based on actual events in 1991 when there is a civil war happening in Somalia, in Mogadishu. And diplomats from North and South Korea are trapped in the city and have to find a way to get out. So you have the political strife happening in the homeland, as well as the human drama of the people who are going from embassy to embassy, for the most part, and trying to find a way of getting out. And then, of course, the North and the South, things kind of come to a head. Without giving away a whole lot, guess what? They kind of have to work together. Well done, claustrophobic feel to it. There's the human drama aspect of it. There's this was shot in Morocco, and they capture. It looks really, really good. And but the action sequences, the chase scenes, and the gunplay are unsettling. And that's something to say because every other film out there is an action film. So this is one that shakes it up a little bit. And so good use of claustrophobic feel mixed in with the action, mixed in with the human drama. So, yeah, look for Escape from Mogadishu on Wellgo USA Entertainment. finally on film movement from Brazil is a drama called Memory House, and it's a film about racial tension in modern Brazil. We have an indigenous black man from the north who moves to a southern town, which is also occupied by Austrian expats, working in a milk factory. And the locals just keep on pushing. And this is a modern-day setting, although I mentioned North and South, and I think here as Americans we start thinking of other things and other places, but the intent still happens. So there's that aspect, a slow burn by our lead, and then there's a connection with a younger person that we think is going to go one way, and it winds up going another. But a good slow burn from the drama Memory House on Film Movement home video. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Oh, also forgot, from Corneth Films, there is a 5-film collection of their recent historical dramas that have been released. Haberman, The Chronicles of Melanie, Remembrance, Within the Whirlwind, and Calm at Sea. So if you're in the world cinema and historical dramas, there you go. Okay, happening over at IU Cinema, depending on when you listen to this, if you're listening to this Friday evening, at 10 o'clock, the Not Quite Midnight series, they're showing last year's drama horror, Titan. On Sunday, the 23rd at 1 o'clock, as a part of the International Art House series, the documentary The Rescue. Tuesday, January 25th, a special virtual event, the 1971 film version of The Trojan Women. This is a virtual film screening program by IU Chancellor Michael A. McRobbie with an introduction by IU Cinema Director Dr. Alicia Kozma. I actually have this. I found this at Half Price Books on DVD about a month or so back. If I don't log into this, I might have to actually sit down and watch that. Thursday, January 27th at 7 o'clock is a part of the Underground Film Series, Taka and Ako, the Luminaris Cinepoetics. Friday the 28th, as a part of the International Art House Series at 7 o'clock, a new 4K restoration of the 1989 film Chameleon Street. On Friday at 10 p.m., as part of the Not Quite Midnight series, at 10 o'clock, the 1981 film Possession. And then Chameleon Street will be shown again on Sunday, January 30th, at 1 o'clock. And then at Tuesday, February 1st, President's Choice series, 7 o'clock, Electra from 1962. And Thursday, February 3rd, is a part of the 5X series at 7 o'clock, All That Heaven Allows. All that is happening over at IU Cinema. This weekend at the Can-Can, we have Drive My Car, as I mentioned, The Tragedy of Macbeth, and Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. Coming up on the 23rd and 24th, All About My Mother and a Human Voice. On the 26th and 27th, Volver. January 25th will be a screening of Slaughterhouse-5. And then starting January 28th, the latest film from Pedro Almodovar, Parallel Mothers. January 29th, Labyrinth with Vanity Rex. Titane will be on January 31st. And then February 2nd will be Groundhog Day. Flea will be starting on February 4th. Over at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin this weekend, 2 and 7:30 p.m. on Saturday and 7:30 p.m. on Friday, Operation Petticoat from 1959. Yeah, Cary Grant and Tony Curtis. I wonder if Tony ever did the impression of Cary Grant in front of Cary Grant. Hi, Helen. January 28th and 29th at 2 and 7:30, Friday at 7:30 p.m., Saturday at 2 and 7:30 p.m., Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, which means the film is still ending. Friday, February 10th, as they have a 1:30 screening on Thursday. This is 55 or over, courtesy of Swartz Family Community Mortuary. And then February 11th and 12th at 2 and 7:30 p.m. at the Historic Art Craft Theater is Roman Holiday, 1953. Romantic comedy with Audrey Hepburn and Gregory Peck. And the AV Club had a nice write-up on Roman Holiday last week. And then Sponsor's Choice, February 18th. Mark your calendars on this 7:30 p.m. High Plains Drifter, which I just revisited on Blu-ray about 2 or 3 weeks ago. I refer to this as High Noon Goes to Hell. It also reminds me the best paper I ever wrote in my academic years. When I was in college, I did a piece on the westerns of Clint Eastwood. Unforgiven had just come out, and I was lumping. Basically, there were four categories: the spaghetti westerns, the I'm Not Like That Anymore, which was Unforgiven, and The Outlaw Josie Wales, and then Is He Live or Is He Memorex, which was High Plains Drifter and Pale Rider. And then there was all the kind of a miscellaneous of the others: Joe Kidd, Two Mules for Sister Sarah, Paint Your Wagon, and I just remember watching this in my off-campus apartment, and my roommate Gail coming up during the first 5 minutes of the film and just saying, "They're not saying anything." So, just a very low volume of lines in High Plains Drifter. But no, still holds up for me. It does. Okay, friends, let's grab a pencil and let's find out what you've been watching. So hopefully you've been able to watch some films that are new or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. And we start on Twitter, I should say, with Dan, who says, last night finally watched Scream for the first time, the original one from 1996. And I know it's being much talked about because the new Scream is out. For me, I was 26 when that film came out, and you know, mentioning the cliches in your film and still doing them didn't quite do it for me. But what do I know? I just have a film show. Okay, great title. Your Canadian Girlfriend writes Superfly, Shaft, Last Night in Soho, and the 25th anniversary Blu-ray of Liar Liar. Thank you, Your Canadian Girlfriend. Helen sends me a GIF of Cary Grant calling Joan Fontaine monkey face. That's always good. Anne writes The Kingsman. Anne writes, I miss Colin Firth, but I loved it. J.A. writes, I finally watched The Godfather. All right. Very cool. And I think that is it on Twitter. So now we go to Facebook. We go to last week's post, because that's how Zuckerberg works. Last week, Leslie writes, Encanto. David writes, Voyage to the Planet of Prehistoric Women, Don't Look Up, and RBG. I know you, David. This is probably a triple feature, so way to go on that. Ray writes, Mr. Warrant, The Don Rickles Project, wonderful little documentary that John Landis made in 2006, and absolutely stunning how many of the people interviewed are gone 15 years later. Yeah, Ray, I do remember that documentary, liked it as well, but yeah, we're just getting older, Ray, that's all. Glenn writes, The Tender Bar. Ross writes, Eternals. Thomas writes, The Philadelphia Story and Some Like It Hot. Taylor writes, Maverick, R.I.P.D., Dunkirk, Murder on the Orient Express, and No Time to Die. Steven Solon has a running bit with me. I watched a movie, The Unforgiven, chosen because it was less than 2 hours long. Thank you. Jeff writes, the 1947 version of Nightmare Alley, and deemed it good. James writes, Encounter with the Unknown, 1972. Wayne writes, The Eternals. Kevin writes, The Tender Bar. Rachel writes, Young Detective D, The Rise of the Sea Dragon. Eric writes, Being the Ricardos. Michael writes, The Sands of Kalahari, The Unforgiven, from 1960. The Way West, Support Your Local Sheriff. Battleground, The Tragedy of Macbeth, Mother/Android, and The Colony. Another Michael writes, Eyes of Tammy Faye. Stephen writes, Angel Face, Friar Fail, and Mysterious Object at Noon. Vin writes, I watched Internal Affairs from 1990. I love Andy Garcia. This was a great film. And then adds trivia from IMDb. Richard Gere and Andy Garcia reportedly did not get along during filming. Some of the scenes in which they were required to hit each other, particularly the confrontation in the elevator, were allegedly for real. Garcia subsequently refused to end the rap party. It's called acting, dear boys. Try it sometime. Joellen writes, Don't Look Up, deemed it meh. Dial M for Murder, and deemed that just as good as it always was. Sean writes, Ghostbusters Afterlife and The Eyes of Tammy Faye, the documentary, not the feature film. Darcy writes, Searching for Superman. Sean writes, Eternals, and deemed it meh, as well as the 1978 Superman. Seth chimes in, I watched the first 10 minutes of Eternals, looked kinda effin' ponderous. Thank you, Seth. Christina writes, The Original West Side Story. Joe writes, Civilization, A Personal View by Kenneth Clark, 1969. Lilies in the Field, The Defiant Ones, 1883, Thunder Road, and The Thin Red Line. Leslie chimes in this week and writes Spaceballs. John writes Scream. Mario writes Django Unchained. Melissa writes Scream, the most recent one, and Someone Great. Lou writes Deidre and Lainey Rob a Train, Queen Pins, A Chorus Line, The Animated King and I, Book of Love, and Space Sweepers. Eric writes First Time Viewing, Cleo from 5 to 7, Dune Part 1, The Chalk Garden, The Learning Tree, The Tender Bar, and Being the Ricardos. And I know I believe The Learning Tree is getting a Blu-ray release by Criterion if it hasn't come out already. For Eric's rewatch, History is Made at Night and El Dorado. Let's see. Oh, there's a nice exchange of Terry. I also watched I watched Cleo from 5 to 7 for the first time some months back. C'est magnifique, I thought. And then Terry asks about Dune. Eric responds, Dune is well worth watching. Respectful of Frank Herbert's vision. Epic in scope, beautiful to look at. Chalamet, not bad as Paul. Okay. Pat writes Scream 4 and Scream or Scream 5 or Scream 20, 22, whatever it's called. Thank you, Pat. Don writes Grease, Casablanca, and The Warrior Queen. MJ writes Animation That's Not for Children, The House from 2022. Jamie writes, I watched Encanto again. I actually plan on a third viewing today or tomorrow. I'm also watching Jungle Cruise on the day I don't choose Encanto. Thank you, Jamie. Taylor writes The Hobbit Trilogy, The Suicide Squad, Mr. Lucky, Enola Holmes, Murder on the Orient Express, and Death on the Nile, the Peter Ustinov version. And that was my first Agatha Christie and Hercule Poirot film I saw in the theaters at the Flint Cinema on Dort Highway. My dad and I got to see that. So, Stephanie writes Chef with Jon Favreau, great movie. Careful, Simon. Don't say anything. That was easy. You know, I don't have to tell Simon how to feel about his films. That just cracks me up. Gretchen writes, Kurt Vonnegut, Unstuck in Time, and The Lost Daughter. Joan writes, The Tender Bar, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And Gretchen also chimes in, also A Raisin in the Sun. I love it when they forget in their original post, don't edit it, but just add a new post. So, Joshua writes Quadrophenia, The Velvet Underground, Brazen, which he deemed that was something, The Conjuring 2, and Deep Cover, which I know also got a Criterion treatment recently. Thomas writes Lilies in the Field, Some Like It Hot, and Spinal Tap. Darren writes The Power of the Dog, Don't Look Up, The Lost Daughter, Tick, Tick, Boom, Being the Ricardos, Passing, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, The Last Duel, Athlete A, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind, Silver Linings Playbook, Colin in Black and White, Summer of Soul, and Prayers for the Stolen. Thank you, Darren. Herb writes Tokeland, 2019. Doug writes The Great Waltz, For Whom the Bell Tolls, Carmen Jones, Paper Moon, Camp, Joyful Noise, Come From Away, Tick, Tick, Boom, and The Tragedy of Macbeth. Mark writes Encanto and Stand By Me. David writes The Tender Bar. Jenny writes Encanto, Eternals, and Tick, Tick, Boom, finally. Craig writes The Court Jester. Just have the Malice in the Palace. Chalice in the Palace and the Vicar Who is Quicker. I was thinking of the Malice in the Palace. Sorry, Pistons guy here. Joe writes Shop Girl, The Hunger Games Trilogy, and Eternals. Trilogy with four films. Yeah. Daniel writes In the Heat of the Night, Mel Brooks Unwrapped, High Anxiety, My Man Godfrey, Parallel Mothers, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Kapalu, Nichols and May, Take Two, Stardust Memories, The Soft Skin, The Matador, August Osage County, High Heels, Repeat Performance, Strangers on a Train, House of Gucci, and This Gun for Hire. Thank you, Daniel. Michelle writes Lucy from 2009, Bad Therapy, and No Way Out. Kate writes Searching for Neverland. David writes The Tender Bar. Rachel writes Encanto, Bruce Almighty, Encino Man, a top five pick in our house. Wow. And Spaceballs, which my son declared to be the second funniest movie he's ever seen. Behind Nacho Libre, of course. Don't you love sons? Dustin writes The Pirate, the 1961 TV movie of Macbeth, 1974 TV movie of Antony and Cleopatra, The Hours, August Osage County, Ailey, and The Power of the Dog. Lisa writes The House of Sand and Fog. I had forgotten how depressing that movie is. Yeah. I hope you didn't watch that, Lisa, and then go straight to bed. Always watch something else to cleanse your palate. Archer, Bob's Burgers, Pingu, anything. Abby writes Twister, Timeline, and Captain America Civil War. David writes On the Fiddle, a Sean Connery comedy before he was Bond. Thank you, David. Matthew writes Life of Brian. I'm working the run of Jesus Christ Superstar, so it was the perfect way to wind down after the stress of load-in and opening night. Well, I hope you get some rest, Matthew, and look out for the Judean People's Front. Amy writes, In the Heat of the Night. And then, for a palate cleanser, Beverly Hills Cop, Gotta Stay Grounded. Amy, look who you're talking to. You're not talking, you're writing on my Facebook page, but you know what I mean. Jessica writes Eurovision, Luz, A Girl Walks Home at Night, Eternals, Spring, Come True, Antlers, The French Dispatch, and Shutter Island. Zachariah writes Rose Plays Julie, A Hero, Slalom, and The Night House. Michelle writes, I watched the strangest movie last night called House. It's with felt puppets and a borderline horror movie. Ah, yes. Very unsettling. And then writes, you should check it out. It's right up your alley. Thank you, Michelle. I miss you, dear. Joan writes The Lost Daughter, and I was very disappointed. Olivia Colman was good, but the movie was meh. Okay, Joan. Elaine writes Anon, the girl with the dragon tattoo. But which one? Andrea writes Lilies in the Field. Dave writes Power of the Dog and Look Up. Kurt writes The Spy Who Loved Me at Belle Trace and a special showing of The Butler for MLK Day. All right. Austin, Medium Cool Podcast. I guess this week is the episode where you hear my top five films, so go look out for the Medium Cool Podcast. Bernadetta, Spider-Man No Way Home, The Last Duel, The Killing of Two Lovers, Encanto, and Hotel Transylvania, Transformia. Shannon writes Fiddler on the Roof. Rob writes American Traitor and The Trial of Axis Sally. Carrie writes The Courtship of Eddie's Father. Lucinda writes Unbroken. Jay writes The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Very good. Jay writes the 355 and Scream. Kate writes The French Dispatch. Terry writes A Letter to Three Wives, The Quiet American from 1958, Niagara, The Trouble with Harry, and Princess Tam Tam from 1935. Eric writes The Defiant Ones and Lilies in the Field. Phil writes the director's cut of Das Boot, Escape from Pretoria, and Tokyo Godfathers. Julia writes The Friends of Eddie Coyle. Great choice, Julia. British Agent, The Wedding Singer, Becoming Bond, As Good as It Gets, Something's Gotta Give, and Belfast. Christy writes Spencer, The New Scream, and If an Infinite. John writes Maid, a mob movie riding The Sopranos' coattails in 2001. I remember that. Not sure any movie has had this many big star cameos and roles with such a bad script. Ow. Lisa writes Dance of the 41. Mike writes Devil All the Time, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, both today. Double feature. Eden writes The Tender Bar and Encanto. Martin writes The Last Duel. And then Ross chimes in, I gave it about 30 minutes, but before I shut it off,
I was really interested in it, though. Should I get back to it? Yes. And Martin writes a really nice, eloquent review, and then I wrote, or you could watch Rashomon. So, but yeah, it's good. It's just a very expensive reminder that men are a terrible gender. I should know. I'm one of them. David writes Eternals and Encanto, and then chimes, I guess this was E-movies this week. Robert Muggy, Terror in a Texas Town, Dr. X, The Sparks Brothers, The Tragedy of Macbeth, The Matrix Resurrections, Bergman Island, and the two-strip Technicolor in the 1932 Dr. X was pretty interesting. It seemed to have every color but blue, with an emphasis on green and orange. But for me, the treat of the week was the Moby Dick Western Terror in a Texas Town. Thank you, Robert. Steve writes, this is here. First off, I love you guys for posting all this stuff. And every now and then, you just get a curveball of a title. And Steve hit me this week with not Shawshank Redemption, because that's playing somewhere on network or on cable television, but Waterloo. The Rod Steiger as Napoleon film version of Waterloo, 1970. Very expensive. Didn't do well at the box office. Although, you know, watching Rod Steiger kind of chew scenery, that's a guilty pleasure. Not really a guilty pleasure. I just like watching him chew scenery. There was a great article about Steiger near the end of his career and life that I believe the article was called 60% Artist, 40% Whore. And that kind of summed up his acting career and or choices. So anyway, good call, Steve. He said the fiance had never seen it, so needed to expose her to an amazing piece of cinema history. Thank you, Steve. I did that with Mrs. Sosie, and, well, 22 years, we're still together. Thank you, Lynn. Rachel writes, Howl's Moving Castle. Daniel writes, Journal for Jordan. Michael writes, the original Rollerball from 1975. Good choice there. JJ writes the original Black Christmas, Long Story Short, The First Predator, and The King's Man. Beth writes Adult Life Skills. Anthony writes The Devil's Minor, a documentary which he deemed A with three pluses, not just one. Aaron writes Spider-Man No Way Home and The First Matrix. Gail writes Unicorn Store, Black Bear, and Swiss Army Man. Devin writes Hotel Transylvania, the first one. Alan writes, The Tragedy of Macbeth. The lighting, art direction, and camera work tell the story even without the dialogue, which is spoken with much intelligence and little histrionics. Thank you, Alan. Lee writes, Drive My Car, and deemed it excellent. Jason writes, The Thin Red Line. Pamela writes, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, Dead Man Walking, and Tootsie. And finally, Spencer writes, oh, this is good. You know, I like comic booky stuff, so this certainly isn't your high-end cinema type of pick, and it isn't new, but I was surprised by how much I liked Guns Akimbo. Daniel Radcliffe in the movie I would have found Oscar-worthy when I was 14 years old. I do know the film you speak of, Spencer. I have not seen it myself. It does look like pizza and beer movie night. Nothing wrong with that, but yeah, you know, Radcliffe is... I remember one of my former co-workers here and I were talking about when, especially in Radcliffe's career, and he made the point that he'll always be Harry Potter to me. And I'm like, and that's kind of unfair because you're already just going to dismiss his 20s and beyond because he's still going very strong with his career. And, you know, it'd be like saying, oh, you know, when they die, more than likely it could be Harry Potter actor. But it would also be like when Tom Hanks dies, you refer to him as the Bosom Buddies star. There's more to the career than that. So anyway, Spencer, you get the last word on that. So thank you. So there you go, friends. You've watched quite a bit. So that was fun. And hopefully you found some films that were new or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Before we wrap things up, I should talk about a couple other older titles I watched. I'm going through the BBS box set from Criterion. So I watched Easy Rider. Watched also Five Easy Pieces. So we're at a point now where my lovely wife, Lynn, the one who lets me call her Mrs. Sosie on the radio, she will come down and work on her laptop and listen to whatever I put in. And Five Easy Pieces is You know, it's an excellent film. She also came in on the last 10 minutes of Easy Rider, and I thought, well, I should put something softer in the next night. And I put in, it was uplifting, but it was also heavy in its own way. But I revisited Bruce Beresford's Tender Mercies, which I absolutely adore. I love Horton Foote's writing. Duvall's great in it. And it's not a light film, but didn't seem as cynical as Five Easy Pieces or Easy Rider. But and I wound up welling up with tears because that film does it for me. And Horton Foote does that for me. So anyway, and then I think a couple nights before that, I put in Bringing Up Baby because I wanted to put in something light. So if my lovely wife is going to come down and sit next to me and work and listen to what I'm putting on, I try not to put on, well, I'm trying not to put on anything that's too harsh. I don't think I'm watching Glengarry Glen Ross if my wife is in the living room, so I can watch that while she's sleeping. So anyway, there's a little insight to the film sociology screening room at home. I want to raise a glass to actress Yvette Mamou, one of the great names in Hollywood and show business. She passed away earlier this week. I know the first two things she got known for right out of the gate was 1960s The Time Machine and Where the Boys Are. And if you've never seen Where the Boys Are, it is a spring break movie from 1960, and it's pushing the boundaries a little bit, but then it really pushes the boundaries with the ending. It is not a Frankie and Annette movie by any stretch of the imagination. So beware of that. But check it out as well. See, also from 1960, Platinum High School, and then Light at the Piazza, Toys in the Attic, which I just listened on a podcast, made reference to that film. Diamond Head, Looking for Love, Joy in the Morning, The Reward, Monkeys Go Home, Dark in the Sun, Three in the Attic, which is one of the films that's mentioned in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, The Picasso Summer, The Delta Factor, The Caper of the Golden Bulls, Skyjack. Yes, I believe she was a stewardess in Skyjack. That's with Charlton Heston. The Neptune Factor, Journey in the Fear, Jackson County Jail. Don't make that a date movie. The Black Hole. Yeah. Circle of Power. And then some TV work. So, yeah, salute to Yvette Mamou. All right, friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. And keep streaming. And hopefully you'll find, again, films that are new or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. And thanks again for Simon Majumdar to come on the show. I like having him on whenever possible. And there were still a slew of film titles that we didn't even get to because of time restrictions. So hopefully we'll get him on soon to preview season 8 of Eat My Globe. Check out his podcast. It's also SimonMajumdar.com. And check out his page. We're going to end this week's show with a little audio tribute to Meatloaf. And yes, you know, the guy who starred in Black Dog as well as Fight Club, among other things. And yes, as I wrote on social media, you can keep Bat out of Hell. You can really keep Bat out of Hell, too. And the less we talk about his performance at the Mitt Romney rally, the better. But for cinema fans, he'll always have Eddie from the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And I know I was just saying earlier you about Daniel Radcliffe and his career. And I just contradicted myself, but that makes me human. And you're human the same way as well. So anyway, let's leave a little bit from the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and we'll chat next week. Thanks for participating. Thanks for submitting to Facebook and Twitter. And we'll try again next week. Take care, everybody. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!